Let's take a listen to this piece here.
This has nothing to do with you. You go to your closet and you select, I don't know, that lumpy blue sweater, for instance, because you're trying to tell the world that you take yourself too seriously to care about what you put on your back. But blue represents millions of dollars and countless jobs. And it's sort of comical how you think that you've made a choice that exempts you from the fashion industry when, in fact, you're wearing a sweater that was selected for you by the people in this room from a pile of stuff.
From a pile of stuff. That was indeed the very great Meryl Streep from The Devil Wears Prada in the role of Miranda Priestly, editor of Runway magazine. And of course, as everyone knows, the character was inspired by real-life Vogue editor Anna Wintour. Anyway, that was one of the most famous quotes from the movie about influential the fashion industry is, even when it comes to the simpler, kind of cheaper clothes that the less fashion-conscious of us might choose to wear. Ding! Did you ever wonder what determines, though, what's in fashion each season? Why certain colours are dominant? Why certain trends are in or out or whatever? Anyway, here to explain how fashion works is fashion journalist Amory O'Connor. And what I want to know more than anything, Amory, is this. Not just how do designers come up with their line each season, is there one person, is there an Anna Wintour, is it Anna Wintour, responsible for deciding what's going to be, and I'll use this in inverted commas and you know I'm going to do, in. I mean, like, you know, like what colour, what particular look. Is that why sometimes different designers' lines can look very similar?
That's exactly it. And I tell you, it goes to one source. Back in the day, it used to be the fashion scout. The fashion scout was hired by designers to travel the world, to go to shows, to go to boutiques, to check out street style and to report back, as it were, with various trends, be it colours that they would predict would be big for next season. Since then, this has been centralised into what's called a trend forecasting service. So it's a bit like the weather.
What?
It's a bit like the weather. It's like fashion's version of the Met Office.
Being serious.
So you'll have two kind of services. WGSN is one of the biggest ones. So if I'm a designer, I'll pay a subscription fee. I'll be able to go in and check out what colours will be big for the coming seasons, for the next season, maybe the season after that, the patterns, the prints. I can actually download sketches if I want. I can get inspiration from pictures, graffiti, scenery, street style, whatever it may be, in addition to archival images of runway shows dating back to whenever. So that's why you see, for instance, if you go into the high street now, I was just over in Dundrum, you'll see lots of red. So, you know, that blood red is a big colour. And people often ask, how is it that, you know, the catwalk shows, do they all have some sort of, you know, centralised vision where everybody knows, you know, what's going to be big? How is it? Is it coincidence? It's not coincidence. It's planned coincidence, because at the end of the day, this is a $300 billion industry and they need to get it right. So it's a bit like predicting, like Mystic Meg, but it's very much predicting with a focus, knowing.
OK, but now in the middle of August, when you say red, is that red for the autumn?
That's red for the autumn.
It's not red for this week until the end of August.
No, now we're in transitional phase. So we're in between seasons. So that's not the place you want to be. That's always that's what they call pre-fall. So what designers have done now is they've bridged the gap with these collections, if you will, these bridge collections that just basically generate a bit more money, because fashion is based on newness. So spring, summer is dead and gone. People are tired of seeing pastels, of seeing crop tops. It's too cold to wear them. So pre-fall has come out now. The autumn, winter drops, the heavier stuff in terms of, you know, the big coats and things like that will come out more like September, October.
Okay, but if you say like that designers decide which of the proposed colour stories, as you call them, kind of has the wearable and saleable appeal for the customer base, it still means that somebody somewhere is more or less telling them what to do.
Exactly. That's it in a nutshell.
So that's it in a nutshell. Really, like, you know, every single person following all this is a bit sheepish, like, as in there's not that, like, if you want to stand out, you got to stand out.
I mean, if you want to stand out and do your own thing, you can march to the beat of your own drum. But essentially, the reason why these colours are picked or these silhouettes are picked is that they know that it will sell. For instance, pastels were bought about two seasons ago. People just start getting used to it. If you pull out pastels too soon and say, this is a big colour for you, people are going to say, well, I've only started to get used to this now. Yeah. And also, you have to bear in mind, I suppose, at the moment, economically, even though it's not as bad as it was when the recession first hit, people are still mindful of their spend. So they'll want maybe an item that they can get a couple of seasons out of. Yeah. And they don't change. Although we love change, we don't want to embrace it too quickly all the while. So that's why, you know, they might roll out pastels for another season. So you get the sense that, oh, I'm getting more bang for my buck. I can still roll out what I had from last season and give it another whirl.
Okay, now I'm going to throw back just one sentence to you, which I think is of your own. Here goes. Long-term forecasting is a broader angle and isolates paradigm shifts in demographics along with the changes in psychographics from consumer values and expectations to economic, political and cultural alliances between countries, assessing their potential impact on the company's bottom line.
I wrote
Holy
that.
Shit,
go
of
me.
God
well,
almighty.
Let me break it down for you. Here's the thing. If I'm a fashion forecaster or fortune teller,
are you, by
I'm
the way,
looking,
is that part of what you do? You would feel you are, no?
Not at all, no.
Okay.
There are two parts. It's a two-pronged approach. There's short-term forecasting, there's long-term forecasting.
Yeah, you were saying that.
Short-term
yeah.
is all about what's now. So what's happening, what's current, what's big. So for the likes of just say a high street brand, like they just say, for instance, River Island about a year and a half ago did a collaboration with Rihanna. Rihanna was at her peak at the time. She still is at her peak, but she was really trending then. She was very big. It was relevant to their customer base. So they did a collaboration with her. When you're looking at long-term forecasting, you're looking at things that are going to have, like, the economy. You know, you'll have getting that information in. In other words, what was really interesting is to see how the department stores changed their brand profile after 2009. You had very high-end brands, and they had to start bringing in not middle of the road brands that had an easier entry point for customers so that they can still keep them as customers, and that when their spend improves, they might then start buying the Prada and the Gucci and the whatever. So you're looking at things like the economy, cultural alliances as well. Like, you know, if you look at what's happening in the world at the moment, the amount of strife that there is, these are things that are taken into account as well. Mm. And it kind of ties into what Miranda Priestley was saying, like, a lot of people pass off fashion as being, you know, the stuff of, you know, that's fuzzy and effervescent and unicorns and rainbows. But at the end of the day, it wouldn't be such a mass industry, like $300 billion industry. Yeah. That's a huge turnover. So they can't really afford to make a mistake.
OK, tell me then about fashion designers. Who are they? Are they individuals who work alone? Do they work for fashion houses, freelance, individual clients, mass market? What is it?
You named them all. Bless you.
And they're all different ones.
They're all different ones. Like, if I'm a fashion designer, I have many avenues that I can take. I can work anonymously for a mass market apparel manufacturer. I can work independently as a designer, whereby I have my own label, just say it's Anne-Marie O'Connor, and I sell it into department stores, into boutiques. I can work with individual clients where I custom make, you know, bespoke clothing for them, or I can work as part of an in-house design team, like the likes of Hollister or Abercrombie & Fitch will have in-house design team, and they'll have a design kind of director over them. And in many cases, they'll have their own fashion forecaster that works alongside with them.
Right.
That will
That's
tell
like
them.
Somebody who works for a brand.
Yeah, somebody who works for a brand. And then you'll have the designers who work for a house. So it's whether it's a Dior or a Prada or whatever that may be.
Okay, well, we did have a cup of coffee earlier on. And
we did.
While we were doing, we were talking about the magazines. And like people who go to the airports, I was saying, might buy a supposed airport novel, which is easy to read on the beach. Mm. But I think, don't they still buy those 180-page magazines, which are 90% ads, which I have no interest in at all. But people love watching those because it's actually easy to read on the beach. And that. And like the fashion magazines, what I'm saying, as opposed to, say, music magazines or stuff, are still doing well. Can do well.
I tell you what, and this is just relevant to what we were talking about earlier. And even, the more high-end ones, the likes of, you know, your InStyle, your Vogue, your Elle magazine, they're all still doing, I mean, it's a very aggressive, you know, publishing world out there, but they're still holding their own. And it's you need to acknowledge that amidst what's happening with online. You know, since the advent of the internet, more so since 2009, when bloggers kind of came on the scene, when you've had the likes of Instagram and Twitter, which have only, Twitter, I think, only started in 2009, Instagram, Snapchat, Snapchat, they've only been around for a few years. And they've really changed the face of everything. Like we were talking about, you can get your information more readily now online. Why would you need to buy the print copy? But I think people are, as you said, there's a picture speaks a thousand words.
Oh, yeah.
These campaigns are what sells the magazine, which is what keeps the readership and what keeps the magazine going. But viewers, or rather readers, like them as well. You know, it's like, who's going to be on the front cover? Which campaigns are we going to use? It's easier to kind of, I can look at which skirt I like, you know, I can dip in and out these kind of little sound bites of information without getting into War and Peace if I'm going on holidays.
Sure.
That said, the September issue, which is out now, is still the kingpin of the fashion calendar. And and I was talking to Tara Lockwood Grant there, and she was saying that she loves the September issue, that she, even if she didn't buy a magazine all
it's
year,
it's the one you'd buy.
It's the one you'd buy. Yeah. And more to the point, in such a populist culture where opinions are ten a penny, it's great to have this one opinion that's the ultimate point of view, whereby all that, there's so much information because there are so many trends. There are micro trends. There are pre-fall collections. There are pre-spring collections. It's almost like TMI. It's too much information. It's information overload. People don't know what they want. Somebody to say, this is what you should buy.
Right.
And it's funny how this is turned on its head, because when blogging had started and became really big, and you had the likes of these bloggers commanding as much presence in the front row at a fashion show as these editors, it's now actually gone a bit out of control. So the whole idea was fashion had become democratized, that, you know, the velvet rope had fallen, everybody had access, it wasn't this elitist point of view. But I think people are now deferring towards that again, and this is where the likes of...
But hold on, when you say people, I mean, like, the high street, let's just say from the big magazine of September, and then Mary blogs in the street, and then in the street or on the street, the middle people are the people who sell the damn things. Is the high street as much a slave to the designer trends and fashion?
The high street really works hand in hand, ironically enough, with the couture and the ready-to-wear collections.
You make it sound like the high street doesn't have much say in it. They just do what all the guys you've just been talking about
street,
the last 20
the
minutes.
The high street produce what's on the catwalk, albeit in cheaper mass-produced, that's easier for us to buy into. I'm not going to be able to buy a couture Dior gown, but I'll be able to buy something that kind of semi-resembles it in the likes of River Island or M&S. So the whole idea of, just to, as an aside, plagiarism isn't allowed, but you can do 5 degrees of difference. So I can change that shirt you're wearing. I can say, I want that, but I'm going to change the number of buttons stitching.
In the same sentence, Amory O'Connor said, that shirt that I'm wearing and I want that.
I told you, you are sporting normcore. You are ahead of the curve and you don't even realise.
Is that good or bad? That sounds like I'm a nerd.
But the high street, just getting back to the high street, of course, is catering to the mass market. The high street will look to what's coming down on the catwalks and create a more distilled version that's more affordable for my pocket and your pocket. What's great about the high street as well is that the high street is really high street and the designers have really come hand in hand since around 2009, 2010. What you have are a lot of these high street collaborations. So Kate Moss for Topshop, you have Versace for H&M. H&M is a great example. They've paired with everyone from Marnie to Isabel Marant. So the designers need to work hand in hand with the high street, because ultimately, you know, it's a way to gain more a broader audience for them, and also more money, because this is why a lot of designers do diffusion lines.
But can I just say, is that one of the reasons why they have to defer so much is because that's where the stuff is sold, or is it sold online more than the high street?
The high street and online, I always maintain that you need to go into a shop to try things on. I love the idea of online, but
I know what people do. They go in and spend 2 hours in a shop, then they go off and buy it online for half the price from Milan or somewhere.
But no, I always believe that you should go in and try it on. For me, anyhow, it's just, I like the idea. I like the process. I like the sanctity of going into a change room, trying things on. The easiness and the immediacy of online is fantastic, but by the same token, half the times I buy things on ASOS, I try it on, I'm like, okay, that has to go back.
By the way, I see what I am now. I have it now. Look,
normcore.
Normcore is a term coined by a New York trend agency, a hybrid of normal and hardcore. Okay. To describe the burgeoning evidence of people looking to fit in rather than stand out from the crowd, and they're fabulous and they're erudite and they're funny and they're really intelligent. Oh, right. Okay. Okay.
ad-libbing there, but you know, you're right. But yeah, again, there was just talking about fashion forecasting and trend forecasting. There was an agency in New York that coined this term. It's relatively new. It's a bit of a neologism in terms of fashion, but normcore was, like we said, it's a kind of a hybrid of normal and hardcore. There is so much trophy dressing. If you look at street style snaps, or if you go to any of the catwalk shows in London Fashion Week, it's peacocking, it's trophy dressing, it's people looking to be photographed. And I think to some degree, people have just kind of railed against that and thought, I just want to blend in, I just want functionality. So normcore refers to those pieces in a wardrobe, anything from your cargo pants and your kind of unbranded sweatshirt to your pool sliders that have suddenly been ironically co-opted by designers.
What's a pool slider?
Pool sliders. You know when you come out of a pool and your feet are wet and you have to put on those, they're like slip-in kind of sandals.
Oh.
Yeah.
I thought you meant those, you know, those swimming pools, not in Ireland, where you slide down swimming pools. I love those things.
That would be interesting. That would be interesting.
Oh, well, look, but yeah, look, and also the thing about, like, things that were a no-no a little while back, and now they've suddenly become the most on-trend thing. Double denim, I'm told, at the moment would be a good example of that.
And that would be normcore as well, as would the likes of Birkenstocks. Birkenstocks were always seen as the kind of provenance of hippies and, like, university professors and what have you. So you've got these Birkenstocks that Celine, which is a luxury Parisian fashion house, had bought them out in, I think it was like spring 2012. The bloggers called them the Firkenstocks because they were fur-lined Birkenstocks. They were hideous,
I know all this. We spoke about this
just
a few weeks
ago. Yeah, we spoke about this the last time. And you remembered it. Well done.
It's about contextualizing.
And I suppose that it's a good example of how things become the new normal. What was once perceived as a no-no always comes full circle. Fashion is the ultimate postmodern expression.
Don't tell me loom pants are coming back, are they?
What?
Yeah, I knew you wouldn't do that. Elephant flares. Just finally, Amory, like, what are the trends then for autumn, winter, so people will know if they can't afford to buy the magazine that's out now, September? Well, the big September magazine's already out, obviously, the clothes that are now coming to the shops, what will people be wearing?
Well, every day is a duvet day in autumn, winter 2014. It's about oversized coats, oversized knitwear, quilting. It's all about lots and lots of coziness. Which is great. There's also a lot of weather appropriate kind of clothing coming out, like outerwear that's kind of like let me rephrase this. Miu Miu has this jacket out that it is kind of like this kaleidoscope vinyl jacket that you could wear out in the rain and still look fabulous. In terms of accessories, there's the solo earring. There is the novelty clutch. There are snakeskin go-go boots. In terms of eras, it's the 60s and 70s. As shearling is big, so are checks in terms of prints, tartan on tartan.
You're on the fabric at this stage, are you?
Again, it's like a smorgasbord. The whole idea is there are so many trends and it's
but
up to Anne-Marie, you to decide which
what's
one you want.
Trending on the smorgasbord mostly though these days? Are we talking about tailoring and knitwear and
tailoring,
stuff?
Tailoring, knitwear,
see,
yeah. I told you, you're ahead of the curve. You could be a fashion forecaster,
Dave. Wait a minute, I've also been told jogging pants.
Jogging.
They're cool,
that's more of a street. Yeah, they're starting to be used alongside tailoring. So it's all about the, you know, pairing your opposites, your kind of sharply tailored jacket with your jogging pants. And of course, sneakers, you know, Karl Lagerfeld in the Chanel supermarket.
Of course.
Of course, Dave. But of course.
Anne-Marie O'Connor, as usual, fab. Thanks a million, Anne-Marie.
Thank you. Hey, now.